How's it going, everybody? Brian Alvarez here on Figure Four Daily. It's Tuesday, February 16th, 2010, here at figure4online.com/wrestlingobserver.com. Joined today by Jerry Jarrett, longtime promoter, a wrestler, done pretty much everything in this business. And Jerry, how you doing?
Good, Brian.
And I wanted to talk to you about a lot of different things today, including a lot of the stuff that you did. I mean, it's obviously very interesting that you're one of the people that actually started out in this business as a promoter before you were a wrestler. That's a fascinating story. We'll talk about that. But I did want to talk about the big announcement yesterday, since obviously you were the co-founder of TNA. They have announced they're moving to Monday night. And I guess, what do you think of that idea?
Well, I naturally wish them a lot of luck. What else can I say? They're going to be up against an awful lot competing with the WWE, but we shall see.
Now, you obviously, as noted, were the co-founder of TNA, and it's been many, many years. And I guess we should start by talking a little bit about how the whole idea for TNA came together. I was always under the impression that you had been interested in purchasing WCW before they went under, and that whole thing fell apart. And what was the story there?
Yes. A group out of Boston, an investment group, contacted me and said, do you think that WCW is... can be turned into a profitable enterprise? And I said, yes, of course it can. So the people up there, John Corcoran, with Trinity Partners, they talked to Siegel, I think, and got the financials and sent me the pertinent information, and I... you know, sent them back a proposal of how I thought we could turn it around and make it profitable. And so they, based on that, they made WCW an offer and of $70 million, and WCW didn't respond to it.
And obviously, in the end, WCW was sold for... much, much less than that. And what year was it that the proposal that you made came about?
You know, I don't remember. It was right before they closed up.
So very shortly before they were sold for about $2.5 million.
Yeah, I don't know what the figure was or what the terms. I just, you know, I wasn't privy to that information. Brad Siegel had called me down there, and I went to a meeting, and I forget the young lady's name. There was some woman that was trying to put together a management team. I know that Mike Graham was a part of it, and that never came to fruition. And then it was after that that my group made them an offer.
What were some of the ideas that you had that you felt would have helped turn WCW around?
Well, you know, my theory is that wrestlers produce best with hope. And when you put them on salary, you take the hope away, no matter what the salary is. That's their limit. That's all they can make. And, of course, the wrestling business is very tough, even though it's theater and cultivated. You literally risk your life every time you go to the ring. You know, things can happen, accidents. You can fall on your head. So it takes some motivation for them to... you know, put out the very best that they can, the best effort they can. And so my plan was to take everybody off of salary. And those that left, we would rebuild with those that were there and the new talent that I planned on bringing in.
Now, you promoted successfully for many, many years, and I guess we should go back a little bit and talk about that. You started out in your teens as a promoter, and it was actually quite a while afterwards that you kind of, I guess, fell into a gig as a referee, and from there eventually became a wrestler. And how did you get involved in the business in the first place?
My mother was the ticket seller for the Nick Gulas and Roy Welch matches here in Nashville on Tuesday night.
Christine.
So I kind of grew up going to the wrestling matches and had a number of little jobs like, you know, I sold the programs, I took up tickets on the front door, things like that. And so when I got my driver's license, I asked them if I could promote some what they call spot shows. And they let me do it, and I would head out with 100 window cards and, you know, $15 or $20 to buy newspaper ads and promote the little towns around Tennessee and Kentucky. And that's essentially how I got started. I worked the towns real hard and had some luck. And so the wrestlers would ask to be booked on my towns, and kind of a snowball effect. Naturally, when you had the better talent, you know, you were more successful.
How did Christine first get into selling tickets? Because she was basically around the scene forever, really.
Yeah, she answered an ad in the newspaper. She worked at Woolworth's 5 and 10.
Really?
In downtown Nashville, and she answered a newspaper ad. They were looking for a ticket seller.
And man, the rest is history.
Well, that was our start.
So really, she answered an ad in a newspaper, and pretty much everything that you see nowadays as far as TNA and everything, it all really just stems from that ad, really.
Well, yeah, I guess if you want to trace it like that. Of course, there's a whole lot of water has run down the river between those days and TNA.
Yes. Now, you trained to be a wrestler, and I guess that, was it Tojo Yamamoto that trained you?
Yes. And a guy named Sailor Moran. Uh-huh.
And how did you decide, I mean, obviously now was the refereeing deal, the story I heard was that they needed a referee one day, and they called on you to do it. And, I mean, did you ever have any inkling of wanting to get into the ring when you were doing promoting, that sort of thing? Or was it something that after you'd seen it for a while, you decided, you know, I'd like to give this a shot?
No. It was all an accident. I felt more comfortable in the business end of promoting. And one day I was at the office, and one of the referee and the ring guy had an automobile accident. And so they got somebody to take the ring, and they needed a referee. And so Roy Welch said, you referee. I said, I don't know how to do it. And they said, oh, well, just count shoulders. And you've watched enough matches, you can do it.
Sure.
So I headed out and became the referee. And that's how that started. And then, you know, going to the towns, they would get me rides because it didn't pay very much. They'd get me rides with the wrestlers, and I ended up riding a lot with Tojo Yamamoto. And he would say, you know, you're going to these towns as a referee, and you're not making any money. You can make more money if you wrestle. Of course, I said, I'm not big enough. And he took offense to that because he said, you're bigger than I am. Am I not big enough? Oh, no, Tojo, I didn't mean it that way. So anyway, he started training me, and I ended up wrestling.
Hey, you actually were a little taller than Tojo, so I can understand saying you're a little too small. He would take offense to that.
Yeah, I was actually about 4 inches taller than Tojo. Of course, Tojo was 230 pounds, and I was, at the time, about 175.
Sure. Now Nick Gulas and Roy Welch, I mean, would you basically say that you learned all of your, obviously you did some promoting yourself, but did you learn pretty much most everything from them, or who were some of the other influences as far as being a promoter?
Well, naturally, I started out listening to everything either one of them told me. Over time, I decided for myself that Roy Welch was really knew the business, and I wasn't quite so certain how much wisdom was in Nick's instructions. So I kind of patterned my belief in the business after Roy Welch. Then after I started, a tremendous influence on me was Eddie Graham.
Yeah.
And so I would say that, of course, you know, as you go through life, everybody that you interact with, in one way or another, becomes a part of the fabric of who you are. So, you know, I'm sure there was some of Jim Crockett Sr. and Leroy McGurk and Fritz Von Erich and you know, Eddie Farhat, the Sheik, everybody that I interacted with, I'm sure left their fingerprint on me in one way or another, as well as the wrestlers. I know that Bobo Brazil was an influence on me, and Gorgeous George, and of course Jackie Fargo, and you know, everybody in one way or another influences you as you go through life. Some to a great extent, and some very casually.
Any memories or thoughts on the recent passing of Jack Briscoe?
Yes, that was very sad to me. The highlight of my career was a culmination of a program that the locals around here knew it as the Quest for the Title program, with Jerry Lawler trying to become World Heavyweight Champion. And this built up to a title match between Jack Briscoe and Jerry Lawler at the Mid-South Coliseum. And Eddie Graham and I stood at the back of the Mid-South Coliseum. And both of us had tears running down our cheeks, because it was quite an emotional moment. Eddie had helped me, with ideas on the program, and Jack and Jerry were like my children at their first junior pro football game.
Sure, yeah.
It was a proud moment in my life. Jack Briscoe, to me, was in a league with Lou Thesz and Dory Funk. There are some people that, and Nick Bockwinkle is in that group. They were just the very class of professional wrestling. And so, yes, Jack Briscoe was very special.
What do you think it was about Jerry Lawler that, I mean, you mentioned Lawler's name in Memphis, and you know, he obviously had something. What do you think it was about him that made him such a gigantic star in the area?
Well, I've worked with just about everybody in my era. And unquestionably, Jerry Lawler is the most talented wrestler I ever worked with. He had the it factor, charisma. You could give Jerry one line or one idea, and he could go out and totally entertain the fans with a three-minute interview, if that's what you gave him, or I'm sure he could talk for an hour. In the ring, he could literally have a match with a broomstick. No matter who I brought in, I could count on Jerry to make them, you know, look like they were worthy to be the champion. And there are not many wrestlers around that can just do it all, and he could do it all.
Now, you mentioned the quest for the title, that being the NWA championship, and, you know, Lawler, it was almost kind of a running joke how many times he'd held titles locally and that sort of thing. And why do you think it was that he never became the NWA champion?
It was crazy. But the National Wrestling Alliance, we'd go out to St. Louis or Las Vegas or New Orleans or wherever the alliance was, and my peers, the promoters, would talk as if it was UFC. And Jerry Lawler did not have the reputation of being a shooter or a tough guy. And, I argued till I was blue in the face. That's like saying John Wayne can't really draw and outshoot everybody in the West. Well, hell, he's not supposed to. It's a movie. But that was the reason. Didn't perceive that he was a shooter.
I could kind of see that through maybe the early 70s, because they did kind of have that mindset, but... You know, once you got into guys like Flair, you know, I think he did a little wrestling in high school, and, you know, obviously many of the guys that he dropped the title to, you'd have thought that, you know, somewhere in there it would have come up that, you know, this is not such an important thing here in the late 70s, early 80s. Let's give it a shot for maybe a short period of time.
Well, see, remember that Lawler's quest for the title was prior to the Jack Briscoe. So you had people like Dory Funk and Jack Briscoe and Harley Race.
Yeah.
And they all had a reputation of being tough guys. Now, later on, you're right. The Dusty Rhodes and Ric Flair and that quit being a criteria. But at the time that we were trying, and then if you're, you know, the history of it is that I finally gave up and got out of the NWA and got an alliance with Vern Gagne with AWA for a little while. And then I just did my own with the USWA.
Now, when Vince McMahon's national expansion began, I mean, it was the end, obviously, for the territories. And USWA, you know, you stuck around there for quite a while. And how were you able to successfully, I guess, hang on for as long as you did in the wake of everything that was going down?
Yeah, well, we were the last man standing, and the reason was is that during the glory days of the National Wrestling Alliance, Tennessee was a lower population center, and it was also in the South, so the ticket prices were not substantial. And that meant that places like certainly New York and Bern Gagne running from Chicago to Denver, the Carolinas, which, you know, extended up just below Washington up into Virginia, all through the Carolinas, Florida, Texas with Fritz, they all were able to attract talent easier than we could. So we were left to develop talent. That's why so many wrestlers trace their start to us. So I knew that I had to find new talent and develop them, and then expect them to move on when they, you know, when they reached a point that they had a reputation. Well, what happened, these other territories that were dependent on wrestlers just picking up the phone and calling them, when Vince started, they all, you know, they folded quick. And with us, we just relocated and reloaded and came up with another crew. And we were able to continually, you know, continue to do that. And it kept us in business.
Now, what were the circumstances behind the deal with WWF and USWA? This was around the early 90s, 1992. And, I mean, he was in the middle, I mean, like you said, last man standing. I think that was right around the time that the Portland territory shut down. And meanwhile, you kind of were working a talent exchange with him as far as some of the Brian Christopher and others were heading into WWF, and some of the WWF guys went down to USWA. And what happened there?
Okay, Vince and Linda and I had a friendly relationship forever. I was real good friends with Vince Sr. And so during all this, you know, it was never a hostile situation. So Vince picked up the phone and called and said, I need some place to keep some wrestlers that aren't booking, and they need to have experience. Would you like to have a little extra of our talent? Of course I would, Vince. You know, who can you send me? So that started this, I guess we were what you might call his first developmental territory. And then, not too long after that started, the government, you know, came up with all this steroid distribution charge, and Vince felt like, right or wrong, he felt like that if something were to happen and he were to get convicted, that I had experience in all the different areas of the wrestling business.
That's right, yeah.
Where, you know, J.J. Dillon was good at what he did, and Pat Patterson was good at what he did, and the accountants and the magazine people, everybody had their little niche, but he asked me to come up while that trial was going on, or while the preparation for the trial, which was about a year, and then the trial. So I went. I had, because of my long-term relationship with his father and with Vince, I felt like that I should help him in this time. I got terribly homesick, and when he was exonerated, I was happy and said, "You don't need me anymore. I'm headed home."
Now, how closely did you follow that trial? And did you think at the time that there was a possibility that he was going away for maybe 5-10 years or whatever, and you might be in charge of WWF during that period? How did you think this was a good possibility, or were you pretty sure he was getting off and you'd just be there for the time being?
Well, I was optimistic, and then I prayed that it wouldn't happen. I had a family and roots and a wife that when I'd fly home, she would cry and not want me to have to go back. And I had a son who was a great amateur wrestler and a terrific football player. And as good as Vince was, he would send me in the limo to the airport. And when a commercial plane wasn't available, he'd rent a jet. He didn't want me to miss any of Jason's athletic contests. But still, I was away from home. And I prayed that it would all work out right.
Now, another very interesting thing about that USWA deal was Vince McMahon went down to Memphis and got a chance to work as a heel performer. And I guess really that was his chance to, I guess, create a prototype of what would eventually be the Mr. McMahon character. And did he enjoy, I mean, he obviously enjoyed it, but I mean, did it really come across as something that he loved to do? He was in his element when he got a chance to play this character for the first time?
Well, Vince and I worked together every day. Vince is a workaholic. And he, even though he had this trial preparation, he was still in the trenches working every day. So Pat Patterson and I would, spend more time at his house than we did in the office. You could say joking, but I really wasn't joking. I told him one day, I said, Vince, you ought to be in the ring. You are the, without a doubt, the biggest heel I've ever encountered. And he said, are you serious? I said, no, you can hurt somebody's feelings just looking at them. And that was the conversation. And then I guess he thought about it, and I thought about it, and we had a lot of conversations. And, I think he confided in me that he had always secretly thought about being a talent.
Oh, yeah.
So I said, Vince, it's real easy. Down in Memphis, that's out in the boondocks, very few people will even know about it. Why don't we start making some interviews? You can go down there and cut your teeth, get used to being in front of the crowds and as a talent, and see how you like it. Well, he loved it, and it verified what I had said. He was great. And Vince is probably, or at least in my opinion, he is the most charismatic heel that's ever been in this business.
That's saying a mouthful.
Huh?
That's saying a mouthful right there.
Oh, well, I mean, look what happened. Stone Cold Steve Austin would have just been another wrestler if he hadn't have been pitted against the villainous Vince McMahon.
It is an amazing thing to think about. You know, when you think about Vince McMahon, he bought the company from his father. You think about all the success he had in the 80s, WrestleMania. And here he is in the early 90s going down to Memphis to work on his heel character. It's incredible.
Well, I mean, Vince had reached a point to where, he could finally do some things that just he wanted to do. And you can't, it's impossible for me to tell you because I've never seen anybody even close to it that is as dedicated and works as long and works as hard at anything as Vince McMahon. I mean, he would just wear me out. We would sit in his den till 2 o'clock in the morning talking. And I would, he had a little guest bedroom there, and I'd go and just crash across the bed, exhausted. And then I'd get up, I'd wake up at like, I don't know, 6 or 7 o'clock in the morning, and Vince would be in his gym working out. I don't know that the man sleeps more than 4 or 5 hours at night. And he just, and he'd be fresh and ready to go, and, you know, Pat Patterson and I were normal human beings. We'd just be exhausted.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Now, when, I mean, obviously, I think you saw Vince several years ago. You actually brought the man now known as Vladimir Kozlov to WWF, or WWE.
Yeah.
And what was the story behind that, and how often do you get a chance to speak to Vince? What kind of terms are you on these days?
Fine. I mean, you know, we don't, I'm in the construction business, and so it's not like we run into each other all the time, but I consider Vince a friend. On the Kozlov thing, it's very simple. Oleg Prudius is, you know, that's his birth name, given name. He has some sponsors that are friends of mine that live up at Brighton Beach, and they are Russian. And so one day Lenny Kaufman called me and said, I have this kid who is a legitimate champion, national Sambu champion, and he would like to be a professional wrestler. Can you help him? And I said, sure, Lenny. Let me make some phone calls. So I called Jeff and said, Lenny is a, you know, is a guy Hulk Hogan size and has the potential to be a great talent. Let's bring him in, and I'll personally train him. And Jeff said, well, let me check with Dixie. And Jeff called back and said, Dixie and I have decided that we can't spend any money on somebody that can't immediately produce. And I said, well, let me tell you, these people are friends of mine, and I'm committed. So you have any problem with me calling Vince, because that's what I want to do. Vince will take him. And because I knew that Vince, you know, respected my... Doesn't that sound strange that Vince would respect me more than the people that were at the company I started?
Yeah.
But at any rate, that's what happened. And so, you know, Jeff laughed. I don't think Jeff realized that I had maintained a friendship with Vince. But anyway, he said, yeah, sure, go ahead and call him. So I called Vince and told him I had this kid, and Vince said, well, if you recommend him, send him over, and I'll put him on a developmental deal, and yes, I'll sign him. And it just, oh, here's the faith part of it. My wife and I often take trips to New York. We go to the theater. Deborah likes to shop there. So we were up there, and Lenny calls and says, when can Oleg go to New York? And I said, well, he can go anytime. Let me call over and see when John Laurinaitis will be there. So I called, and they said, yeah, tell him to come right now. And then John called me back in a couple of hours and said, Vince, I told Vince you were in New York. He said, could you come with him? And I said, yeah, I'd like to visit. So that's how all that happened. And, of course, that really, you know, the Carter family's not really smart to the business, so that got them all bent out of sorts. And,
yeah.
And I was able to make my exit from TNA.
When you were first forming TNA in the early days of the company, and this was before national television, you were still doing the weekly pay-per-views. Did you ever, I mean, were you talking to Vince McMahon at that period? Did you ever talk to him about the idea, and what did he have to say about it, if anything?
Well, you know, no. When we were starting it, it wouldn't have been the thing to do for me to call and say, you know, we're starting this company. I did have a conversation with him to ask, was he aware that that pay-per-view guy, I can't remember his name, but
it was Jay Hassman?
Yes, Hassman. And Vince said, absolutely not. He doesn't work for the WWE. And I said, okay. So, you know, that was the only conversation we had back in those days. But, you know, the TNA thing came about because Jeff could not go back to WWE under any circumstances.
Yeah.
Ever. He had burnt his bridge with Vince. And so WCW was closed, and I tried to talk Jeff into just getting out of the business and coming into my construction company, and he wanted to be in the wrestling business. So you do goofy things for your kids. And that's why I, you know, got back in the wrestling business. My heart really wasn't in it at the time, but I did it. And, you know, hindsight's 20/20. If I, you know, I cautioned Jeff about making it, you know, hiring all the WCW talent and management, that it would, you know, they had done a terrible job at WCW.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was like, I'm in it to help Jeff, and so not for myself, so I yielded to his decisions. And for better or for worse, that's what it is.
Now, Dixie Carter, when she does her speeches, she often talks about how nobody gave us, you know, everybody thought we'd be out of business in 6 months, and here we are. It's 8 years later, or however long it's been. And you wrote quite a bit in your book, and you mentioned Jay Hossman. And, I mean, really, it was, you know, a few months after the whole thing started, for a number of reasons, it was very close to being the end.
Yes, it was. Yeah, Jay just about sunk us. He had us, you know, based on, we believed his numbers, and so we geared up and was spending money like it's water, and we spent, I don't know, $4 million in 6 months.
Yeah. Yeah, for those people that aren't aware of what we're talking about, Jay Hossman was the guy that worked, I guess he was your liaison at the pay-per-view companies. And
yes,
you guys were doing the weekly pay-per-views, and I guess he was giving you numbers, I don't know how high, like, you know, probably in the 100,000 range for these shows, and the actual numbers were much, much lower. And so,
oh, yeah, he was telling us we were having $100,000, $150,000 a week income, and the truth of it was we wasn't having $10,000.
Yeah.
It was a disaster. Well, at $100,000 to $150,000 discrepancy each week, it doesn't take many weeks to go broke.
Yeah.
So by the time we found out the truth and scaled back to the Nashville Fairgrounds, it was just about too late.
Now, how did
and then we were hit with a double whammy. The Health South, Richard Scrucci got in trouble, and so they had to pull out.
And that was your financial backer.
Yeah, so we were really up a creek.
And then the Carters stepped in, and how did that whole thing come about?
Dixie just said that her family wanted to get in the wrestling business. And they wanted to take Health South's position. And Jeff, you know, handled the whole deal between them, and he essentially gave them total control from the beginning. Well, I mean, you know, if you know the history of the wrestling business, when people without a wrestling background get in the business, it's easy to make some mistakes.
Yeah.
Fundamental mistakes.
So for the next couple of years, I mean, really until the Kozlov deal happened, I mean, you were with the company, but I mean, I presume it wasn't your vision for most of that period?
Oh, no, not at all. Matter of fact, my input was probably the first, as far as writing the shows, I'm going to guess the first 20 shows.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, like when the Carters came in, I wanted to get out then. And, you know, Jeff would raise hell and cry and, you know, do the dad, you're deserting me bit.
Sure.
So I stayed, and the stress of it, my doctor says the stress of it is what caused my heart attack.
Yeah.
And, he essentially told me that I had to, that if my wife was causing the stress, leave her. If my business was causing the stress, quit. Whatever was causing it, I had to quit or I was going to die. So as, you know, fate helped me to get out of TNA. And, you know, it was a blessing because now physically I'm better than I have been in years.
Now, you've talked in the past about Vince Russo and how his writing style is pretty much the polar opposite of what you see and what your vision is of the wrestling business. And I guess it's 2010, he's still there, he's still writing, and do you find that in some ways astounding?
Yeah, I just, you know, it's really amazing to me.
Incredible.
You know, I don't know, it's amazing to me that Hitler was able to almost take over the world.
Yeah.
Let alone, I mean, it was amazing that he was able to take over Germany. You know, there are a lot of things that are amazing to me. And, you know, it's just one of those things. My logic will not allow me to explain it to myself. it just, you know, it's, to me, it's illogical. The man just, you know, his track record is, I mean, where has he ever drawn money? Do you know?
I have yet to find the place.
Yeah, I mean, he absolutely closed up WCW that had, when they closed, they had $125 million revenue stream. Now think about that. $125 million income, and you close the doors?
Yes.
And you know, you can say what you want to about Vince McMahon, and he can make all of the wild assertions that he wants to make, but logic does not allow that he was this whiz kid at WWE, turned the company around, and Vince is so stupid he let him go.
Yes.
Now, that doesn't make any sense, does it?
No.
I mean, I can tell you that it didn't happen, but, you know, don't believe me, just logic. So he goes to WCW, and they fail, and then he ends up at TNA, and I have yet to see that they've succeeded. And, I mean, because a company stays in business does not mean that they are a success. Paul Heyman, would you say that ECW was a success?
As far as a company, they ultimately went out of business.
They ultimately went out of business when they were able to quit finding investors. It's that simple. You know, companies that make money don't go out of business. When, you know, the automobile industry, they didn't get in the shape they're in because they were a successful automobile company.
Sure.
And Lord, I don't know. I know in our construction business, if we don't make money, we go out of business.
Well, we've
I've had so many of my friends go belly up, and some of them commit suicide, that it's just, you know, it's heartbreaking. And, but then there are things that justify my logic anyway.
Yeah, we've talked in the past, not you and I, but about the fact that back in the day, I mean, there were very few wrestling companies, if any, that had big financial backers. I mean, you, as a promoter, and you would know this as well as anybody, you, as you noted, had to sell tickets, and you had to make money, or you went out of business. And
that's right.
In 2010, I mean, there are media companies. I mean, WCW was owned by a media company, and they lost money for many years, and then they had a period where they made a lot of money, and then, you know, they found themselves $60 million in the hole, and the media company didn't want to back them anymore. But for a while, it held them up. And it used to be that basically you used to have to be able to promote to run a successful wrestling company. And today, not so much.
That's right. And the talent had to be able to sell tickets. And today, not so much.
What did Jeff see in Russo? Because, I mean, he's been one of his biggest supporters for many, many years. And I don't know if it was because Russo wrote great stuff for him in WWF and WCW or what it might have been, but he always seemed to be a very strong supporter of Russo for really no good reason, I would think.
Yeah, I have asked myself that question more than you can know. I don't have any idea. when Jeff and I were working together every day, I would ask him that. And there was no answer. Now, I can guess, and my guess is that Jeff felt like that, because, see, remember, Jeff's never been in the inner circle at WWE. So he is, his only knowledge about what's going on behind the scenes in the booking meetings is what Russo tells you. So my guess is that Russo spun the circle a story that basically said, if it wasn't for me, kids, you wouldn't be here.
Yeah.
And then I think he goes to WCW and he made Jeff the NWA champion, or the WCW champion. And my wild guess is that some kind of perverted sense of loyalty came out of that. Because Vince Russo told Jeff in my presence, you are not a main event talent.
Huh.
And I said, Jeff said, when we were riding back from Atlanta, he said, what do you think about that? I said, well, I think that I think you were a main event talent for Vince McMahon, and I trust Vince McMahon's judgment more than I do Vince Russo's. I mean, you know, Vince puts that Intercontinental title on people that are workhorses, because you essentially have to go every night, and so you have to. He wants it on somebody that'll draw money and will work.
In 2000, you, actually not in 2000, it was regarding 2000, but you did a kayfabe commentaries, and I guess the theme was rebooking WCW there at the end. And I guess, did you enjoy working on that project? And once it was finished, did you ever look back on it and think, you know, I guess I would have changed this about it?
What, that guest booker thing?
Yeah.
No, I went up to do an interview, and that was a spur-of-the-moment thing, and they said, will you come over here and do this guest booker? They pay you such and such. I said, how long will it take? He said, oh, a couple of 3 hours. I said, okay. So I walk in this, I think it's a hotel room, might have been a studio, I don't remember. And so they gave me a sheet of paper and said, here's the talent, how would you book it? And so I sat down in about 15 minutes and scribbled some notes, and we started the tape rolling. I couldn't tell you what I said.
Sure.
But, I mean, you know, if you go back over all the stuff in Memphis, there's a pattern to it. So, you know, when you have that pattern, that style, it's kind of like, you know, somebody that writes books, when you can really read the first chapter of a book and know that, well, this is a Stephen King novel.
Yeah.
So that's the way it was. I don't know if would I change it if I sat down today. Maybe. I don't know. I haven't looked back at it.
We could probably talk for years, actually, you're talking your entire career, but a couple more questions before we wrap up here for today. I guess as a person who's successfully booked for many, many years, and hearing the story of scribbling for 15 minutes on a piece of paper and then going for 3 hours talking booking, I was reading an interview, and we were talking about Vince Russo, and he was talking about writing the January 4th show when they went head-to-head with Raw, and he talked about how, you know, they locked themselves in a room for 2 straight months writing this show, and it was a 7-day-a-week job, and I always just kind of thought, you know, that's just probably too much work being put into this. I would guess that to be a strong booker, I mean, is and you would be the perfect guy to ask. I mean, is it more about just simplicity and keeping things basic? I mean, is it overkill to be thinking about booking a single television show for two straight months?
Did you see the show?
Yes, I did.
Well, would you, if you did it, how long would you admit to spending after the fact?
I'd say I whipped it up that afternoon.
There you go. And anybody that had walking around since would say that. The truth of the matter is, we used to, I would start working, booking Memphis on the drive back on Monday night. And penciling in some notes for television and some ideas for which matches I wanted to return and how. And then, remember, we'd go back in those days to drive to Louisville on Tuesday and Evansville Wednesday and Lexington Thursday and Tupelo, Mississippi Friday. So in the car, I would work on these, on the Memphis television show. A little bit going to Louisville and a little bit going to Evansville and maybe a total of 3 or 4 hours throughout the week. And that effort garnered an average of a 24 to 26 rating, 70 share, for 15 years.
That's a ridiculous share, by the way.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy. It was a different era, but even with 4 television stations, that's phenomenal.
Yeah.
So the wrestling business is really, really, really simple. And but most people forget that it's entertainment. And so when people go to be entertained, they don't want to have to think about it. Life is tough to think about. They want to be entertained. And too many writers and too many bookers make wrestling too complex and too complicated. It's if you're riding down the street in the morning to go get breakfast or to go to your office or what have you, and you look over at the red light and there is a big bully beating up a little smaller guy, you know, and you watch it. You might even stop the car and get out and think about helping the little guy. And suddenly the little guy starts making a heck of a comeback and just pounding the hell out of this big guy. You go, all right.
Yeah.
Now, that's how simple the wrestling business is.
Yeah.
You don't know these people, but you will emotionally get involved in the little guy making a comeback. And so that's how simple the wrestling business is. It's not complex. It's, you know, and it, I would hate to think that I worked, 2 months on any show. Wouldn't you?
I don't see how that's a thing to brag about.
Yeah, I mean, I'd be embarrassed if it happened to me. I'd figure, well, I encountered 2 months of writer's block.
Yeah. Now, the final question I've got to ask you before we wrap up today is you've talked about your construction company several times, and obviously you've still got a great passion for the wrestling business, but you were able to just step away and work for your construction company, and you seem very happy to be doing that. And I mean, do you ever get that itch again to come back to wrestling, or was it really easy to step away after all you'd done in this business over the years?
Well, if you have to go back and understand that working in a, you know, I'm the father, and working with Jeff, he's the son, and our philosophies are diametrically opposed. I can't think of one single part of the wrestling business that we agree on or ever agreed on. So when you say I walked away, a better phrasing is that I escaped. I mean, it really is. Emotionally, the pressure was so intense. And so the construction business, where I could go and get on a dozer and push a mountain down, or go get on one of my big excavators and dig 20 feet ditch down in the ground to lay sewer or water pipe, that was like, you know, well, I have escaped from Alcatraz.
It's a vacation.
Yeah, and so it was not the kind of situation where I was, you know, Dutch Mantel's a friend of mine, and I talk to Dutch, you know, often. And Dutch got fired.
Yeah.
So he has this burning desire to get back involved. Now, do I ever get the itch? Yes. I have thought about several things. I have a little project in the works with some Hollywood producers. Well, they're really L.A. I don't know why you call them Hollywood. But, you know, they do television now and have some top-rated shows. And I have formed a partnership looking at a project. I have a little international wrestling distribution company. Nothing big. We distribute a little local show here that Reno Riggins produces. I got off the phone earlier with Willie Nelson's management and Merle Haggard and Bobby Bayer's booking agent, and working on a show out in Texas, country music show. And this afternoon I had a long talk with WWE about a little project. So am I involved in things or other than the construction business? Yes. Am I dying to get back in the wrestling business? No, I don't think I ever will. It's, you know, I like living, and the doctor said that the wrestling business would kill me.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't want any stress. If I can do something that's stress-free, I'm a candidate.
Sure.
Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. And I also want to encourage everybody, if they want to hear more from Jerry, you've, of course, written a book, and it's available. Actually, where is your book available? It's the story of the development of the NWA TNA, new concept in pay-per-view programming. Is that in Amazon? Is that available on Amazon, or where can you get that?
Yeah, you can get it on Amazon, or you can get it on eBay.
eBay. So Amazon or eBay are the places to go for that book. And basically, just a journal that you kept, kind of just recapping everything that went down, and a very, very interesting read. And I want to thank you very much for doing the show today, Jerry. It was awesome. And I hope that one of these days we can have you back on, because obviously we talked a lot about TNA, but your career spans way back and just kind of did it all. So I'd love to talk to you again.
Thank you for calling. I've enjoyed it.
And thank you, everybody, for listening. We shall talk to you again later on tonight.